Yeah. It is god awful early on a Sunday morning. And I say god awful, and I have to say that I know that I'm taking his Lord's name in vain, so I should ask for forgiveness. Definitely ask for forgiveness, but moving on. There's a story that I've been wanting to write for quite a long time, and I think for those who follow my blog, you know that I more or less haven't even tried to commit to becoming a writer until, you know, 2011. So I've been kind of doing this for about 5 years now, trying to commit to being a writer. I don't know if I'm good. I don't know if I'm bad. I could really suck. Who the fuck knows? Some people give me positive feedback. Some people tell me they have no idea what I'm writing about. They simply do not understand it. Some people just, you know, just say negative stuff. So I don't know. And frankly, I don't really give a shit, because some of this is just based upon me keeping a promise to two people I love. You know, it's sort of bizarre, but two people I care about, both of whom died of stage 4 cancer, very painfully. You know, whatever they tell you about all the great, you know, opiates they have now, all the great drugs, the net effect of stage 4 cancer is you have to give people so many drugs that it really just does kill them. It might not kill them physically, but it kills their personality. So it's horrible to watch people go through that. But both of these people made the same final request on their deathbed, and I really doubt they compared notes. And they did it, you know, they died within the space of 24 months, and they both said, you know, hey, Dan, stop being ashamed of who you are. So that was kind of a message to me that even if I don't know if I'm a good writer or not, just try it. Keep going. Don't stop. You know, life is not a straight line, and your own path of self-perfection, if such a thing exists, and I just don't think it does, but your own path of self-perfection, whatever the fuck that means, is never going to be a straight line. I mean, I've made progress since my divorce, you know, 3 years ago, but I can't honestly say I've made the progress I expected to make. And if I look around my apartment, in many ways, all I did was transport my existence from Seattle to Indianapolis. But in terms of how I live and experience life, it's kind of the same. So I guess this is a long-winded way of saying that what I'm about to talk about is not about writing. It's actually about physics, but basically the idea, the topic is coming from the writing, and the writing is a whatever. It's a work in progress. If you like it, you like it. If you don't, you don't. I don't know how many people visit my blog. I don't really check the logs. I doubt it's that many, probably 10 or 15, but whatever. But this is the topic. It is not about my own self-conscious thoughts regarding writing. The topic is actually on the subject of wormholes. And here's the thing. I am not a theoretical physicist. I have some academic background in physics. When I say some, please put that in sarcastic quotes, because it's the amount of taking some physics in high school and, you know, reading some stuff as I went through life. I didn't even take physics in college. I basically took psychology. Don't ask me why. It was fucking the early 90s. And to tell you the truth, looking back at my life back then, I'm happy I survived. I made terrible decisions academically and in other ways, but I'm just happy I made it. Anywho, so this is on a physics topic, but I do not claim to be a theoretical physicist. I have a background in computer science, but honestly, I usually put that in sarcastic quotes too, because much of what is done in computer science is really engineering, and I draw a very distinct line between engineering and science. I think science is about discovering, you know, sort of universal truths, things that are true about the physical universe. And I think that engineering is about using those truths or that knowledge to build shit. And so computer scientists build a lot of shit, but I don't really see them doing science. Now, they often do a lot of good theoretical mathematics, but I don't know. People say that math is a science. Maybe it is. To me, math is really a pure almost a purely deductive discipline. Now, with computer modeling and other things, there are mathematicians who would claim there's also a discovery aspect, and there might be. The problem with higher order mathematics, especially when you get into fields like, I think the Argon plane or the space of imaginary numbers that generate sort of the fractal universe of numbers, when you get into subjects of very complex number theory, math can feel like discovery because these universes of numbers are so strange. They almost feel like different universes. But it is still just a higher order deductive system. I'm not trying to be a dick, but it's not like you're figuring out how to fucking cure cancer or you're understanding, the composition of a star. I mean, it is important stuff, but to me, it really isn't science. Okay, so maybe I'm being a bit of a dick. Anyways, physics is science. It is often very theoretical, but where the rubber meets the road with physics, as it does with chemistry and the other true sciences, is in the experimentation and the proof through experimentation. Essentially providing the model, providing the experiment, and showing the results, and publishing, and getting peer review. That's how you're supposed to do science. Apply mathematics to experimentation and publish, and get people's feedback. So, anyways, wormholes. So I read this article in, I think it was Scientific American. It could have been the journal Nature. I want to say it was about 10 years ago, but essentially it's talking about wormholes. And I think they were actually doing an interview with Stephen Hawking, but it might have been somebody else. Honestly, there are so many of these pop scientists who go out there, and Stephen Hawking's not one of them. I consider Stephen Hawking to be one of those actual, real physicists who does real work. But there's a lot of people who go out on sort of the lecture circuit in physics, and they're really not. They don't really seem to be much more than people who published a few papers on derivative topics, if you know what I mean. But Stephen Hawking has come up with really foundational shit. I mean, his sort of bubble universe model of cosmology is really foundational. I don't want to talk about that right now, but he has a lot of stuff that is foundational. So, anyways, it might have been Stephen Hawking, it might have been somebody else, but essentially, the experts. Again, sarcastic quotes, because whatever an expert is in a journal these days, who knows? But the expert said to do anything useful with wormholes, you would essentially need to harness the equivalent of the mass of Jupiter in negative energy. And so let's talk about wormholes first before we talk about that statement. A wormhole is essentially like opening a corridor between two points in the universe. Okay, imagine I want to travel to a nearby star, and the star is several light years away. Well, with current technology, if the star was like 2 or 3 light years away, even with the best technology we have, like, nuclear rockets, ion drives, you name it, using the best technology we have, it would still probably take hundreds of years to get there. I mean, maybe we get there in 50 years, but still, think about that. That's a god-awful long time to be on a spaceship. So when you open a wormhole, however, like imagine you open a wormhole between the Earth and the star, you're essentially turning the distance between this point in space-time and that point in space-time to zero. You're essentially using a strong force of gravity to pull two gravity wells together. And when you pull those two gravity wells together, you essentially create a corridor through space-time. That is one way, one theoretical model of how wormholes would function. But honestly, this is again a very deep topic, and I'm not an expert. I was shocked by that Jupiter-sized dose of negative energy. When I read that, I thought, man, this sounds really cool that they think is possible, but that amount of energy sounds completely ridiculous. Like, even if you could harness the mass of Jupiter's energy, for those who understand the basic idea behind Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, you understand that that translates, if converted to pure energy, into tremendous amounts of energy. People don't realize this, but when a nuclear bomb goes off, even a hydrogen bomb, you're not actually converting all of that mass to pure energy. A lot of it does get converted to gamma rays, but a lot of it essentially gets translated into the kinetic energy of particles, because a lot of it basically is just shattering the matter, and the matter just gets thrown through space, but ultimately not that huge a portion gets converted to pure energy. If you had a bomb that could convert, you know, the amount of mass we use in a nuclear bomb to pure energy, the amount of damage would be several orders of magnitude greater. It would be an amazingly devastating device. And actually, since that device would technically produce probably pure gamma rays, because that is more or less the baseline energy produced from those types of transformations, you know, the matter-antimatter transformation is the classic one. It produces gamma rays. Well, those gamma rays would essentially kill every living thing within a fairly large area. And so the buildings might be left behind, you know, most of them, although the amount of gamma rays would be so significant, I would expect the entire area to be sort of disintegrated, and a crater to be left behind. But like essentially, yeah, a glass crater. But let's hope no one ever does that. But that being said, Jupiter scope level, I mean, converting the mass of Jupiter to pure energy, negative or otherwise, that seems incredibly infeasible to me. I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible. It might not be impossible, but it does sound extraordinarily dangerous. And I can't imagine that kind of travel being without significant risk, not simply for the people traveling, but for the people who have to be living near this thing. You know, this is way worse than the Concorde issue, you know, and the sonic booms being created and the windows being knocked out. If you're converting Jupiter-sized levels of mass to pure energy, wow. You're not going to want to live nearby the solar system that has to be on the opening side of that fucking thing, is all I'm saying. I think you have to create a little zone around that solar system saying, this is an area where we convert gas giants into pure energy and open up holes to other solar systems. So please, you know, don't stay here. You know, this is a dangerous area. This solar system is off limits to people who aren't traveling through these extraordinarily hazardous wormholes. And so essentially what this expert was saying is you would need that level of energy to do anything practical with a wormhole. So when I read that article, I thought, you know, Dan, I know you're not a physicist, but this really, even if it were feasible, this just sounds horribly dangerous and so pyrrhic in its very nature that you might want to avoid this. Like, this is a choice best not made. And it didn't sound likely anyways. Like, I think our hubris, the level of hubris is so great. If we think that we're anywhere near being capable of taking a gas giant and converting it to pure energy. I mean, I know we can do a great many things. And I know that it's very exciting that we can carry our computer in our pocket. But guys, this is mostly about miniaturization and the impact of fossil fuels upon human civilization. When you're starting to talk about taking Jupiter-sized things and converting them pure energy, that's a little bit beyond where we're at. That's that kind of type 1 civilization kind of thing that we're just not even close. Probably type 2 when you think about it. And again, I'm no expert on that scale either, but it feels like you're in a type 2 category if you're converting gas giants to pure energy willy-nilly. Or that you have access to that amount of energy willy-nilly in either case, whatever the source might be. That does kind of remind me of the Star Wars movie, the fucking latest Star Wars movie, The Force Awakens, The Farce Awakens, you know, the trip from Jock Itch to get the band back together. I'm sorry for beating up on that movie again, but actually it is apropos because the Death Star, the super mega Death Star in the new Star Wars movie, basically sucks in stars as an energy source and then sort of farts out or poos out these super hyper-like gamma ray beams that totally vaporize multiple planets. So, yeah. Anywho, this is a horribly dangerous idea, and the Death Stars are terribly dangerous ideas. They never turn out well. They are appropriately named in both that literal and figurative sense, but also ironic in a way. But yes, the Death Star, is the Death Star is appropriately named. You don't want to work or be a contractor on the Death Star because, really, one, its existential purpose is, come on, horrific. Hold on a second. I gotta turn the heater off. Fucking thermostat. Yeah, so it's gonna be winter again here in Indianapolis, maybe. I don't know. It got warm and then it kind of it's cooling off again, but we'll see. Anywho, now that we had that interruption taken care of, yeah, you don't really want to work on the Death Star because it is kind of an existentially horrific thing, and then ultimately it is appropriately named because I don't think a Death Star has ever really survived very long. Once they get done building them, it seems like your days are numbered because of the existential purpose. You're pretty much going to draw in every solar system is going to send a spaceship. The fish head people are going to show up. I mean, come on. They're all going to show up, even the Ewoks, and they're going to blow you the fuck away because building Death Stars is like probably from a karmic point of view, the fucking worst thing you can do. Like, of all the horrible things you can do, maybe building a universal doomsday device would be the worst, but probably the next level down is going around building these really fucked up, horrific Death Stars that swallow suns and fart hyperlight beams. Anywho, so wormholes sound really dangerous to build, and I don't know. They sound really dangerous, and I don't want to talk about quantum teleportation, because I've talked about that before, and I believe that IBM uses quantum teleportation as a smokescreen. I don't think IBM has been, working on transporting boron atoms across the room for the last 2 decades, or 3 decades probably. I think they've been working on, technically speaking, instantaneous communication, or essentially quantum entanglement communication. And on Earth, you'd say, well, why would we need that? Okay, yeah, I guess. Because, everything is so close from a relativistic perspective. Electricity travels fast enough, light travels fast enough that we wouldn't need that on Earth. But actually, it does have features you would want because it allows you point-to-point communication anywhere on planet Earth. And it allows you a highly encrypted point-to-point communication. So actually, I could see wanting to have a quantum entanglement phone. I would want one. They could be awesome to have. But that being said, I don't think IBM's been working on teleporting actual physical things. They've been working on communication devices. The reason for this and the purpose for this, when you think about it, if you can send a drone to Mars, and instead of waiting, a few hours to complete a communication cycle, you can actually live from Mars, watch a drone, control a drone. That's a big deal. You could actually start mining the solar system in a practical way because you wouldn't have to bake so much intelligence into these craft. You could control them essentially in real time. So, yeah, I think this would be a big deal, but this isn't a way to get from point A to point B. This is not a solution to the wormhole problem. Ultimately, if you could use quantum teleportation, it's horrific too, because now you have a copy of yourself. So one of you has to die. So no, quantum teleportation is kind of horrific on so many levels. I can't even begin to explain how I would not want to be teleported. But as a communications device, quantum entanglement is probably that it is going to happen. It might be only a few years away. And when it does happen, it's going to radically upend everything communications-wise, including the internet. The internet will still exist, but it will take on a form that will appear unimaginable because essentially, with quantum teleportation, everybody could essentially be their own website in an absolute sense, in a unique sense. But also, you wouldn't need to have any intermediaries. Like, theoretically, anybody's phone could be a website for 1,000 users, and you wouldn't need to have an internet between them. It's all happening within subspace. So it's a cool technology. It doesn't solve the wormhole problem, but it's a cool technology, and I think it's only a few years away. But wormholes just sound really dangerous, and yeah, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be converting gas giant levels of energy so I can travel around, because I'm just worried that a mistake is going to lead to like some solar system being vaporized. But what if, and this is hypothetical, what if you could do something on a lower scale? And again, this gets back to that story I was working on. The actual main character develops a device that creates synthetic gravity. And let me explain what I mean by synthetic gravity. I don't mean anti-gravity. Anti-gravity, from my perspective, would be almost like a kind of stealth technology, but it's deeper. It's actually like a quantum stealth technology. True anti-gravity would be like wrapping an object within a stealth field that essentially convinces the universe that there is no gravity well there, that essentially convinces the universe that space-time within that region is continuous and there is no gravity well. And without a gravity well, without gravity, without mass, there's no interaction. So essentially, if you create this envelope around your spaceship, if there was a spaceship involved, you would be convincing the universe that there is no spaceship there, not simply in a visible sense. So I'm not sure what this would do, but it is possible that a true anti-gravity would also have the effect of being a true stealth. Like, you would literally become invisible, almost invisible. But that being said, a true anti-gravity would convince the physical universe, space-time. So it would definitely be a space-time stealth technology. And from a space-time perspective, there would be nothing there. It would be just, it would essentially look like continuous space-time. Very low mass or no mass at all. Synthetic gravity is not that. Synthetic gravity is where you project moments of gravity somewhere into space-time. But the way you project it is essentially with a multi-beam system. And in the simple idea, you have two beams. You have an A beam and a B beam. And both of these beams by themselves project, are essentially particle beams, and they both project subatomic particles, which are mostly innocuous, probably not hazardous, and at energy levels that wouldn't really be dangerous by themselves. But wherever they intersect, they create moments of gravity, moments of synthetic gravity. Even though nothing is really there except for two streams of particles, the impact is to create like a moment of gravity that is significant and that is related to energy input in a nonlinear way, so that it doesn't take a lot of energy to create a fairly significant moment of gravity within that projected space. It takes some, though, but it doesn't take an unreasonable amount. And so this character uses these projectors to essentially, you know, move the ship around. So the ship can essentially, it's almost like, you know, chasing a carrot. The ship can project gravity in front of it, and the ship itself chases the gravity, but the gravity is constantly moving through space-time. So I don't know. It might not work in reality, but that's the idea. And the other idea is that because he has multiple projectors, he can actually cancel out the inertial impact. It's more expensive. It probably increases the energy cost of travel by, you know, a factor of, you know, five or greater, but it allows the ability to cancel out inertia and acceleration. So essentially, you could get to very high fractions of the speed of light very quickly without turning the passengers into a liquid goo. So anyways, this is, again, science fiction. I'm not a physicist, so you know what? If you're a physicist and you're saying, Dan, you're full of shit, that's okay. This is science fiction. Please, these are ideas for a story. This is not, this is science fiction. Anyways, in the story, this particular main character has a research assistant who proposes another use for these projectors. And essentially what he proposes is what would amount to a kind of a space-time depixelator or a means of boiling space-time, but essentially a way of decreasing the density of space-time. The idea is not to blow these massive corridors through space-time that require gas giant levels of energy, because, again, that sounds crazy, and it probably is crazy. But maybe using a much lower energy level, but projecting it through space-time in such a way that it's the space-time itself does not become zero. The distance is not zero, but what you do is create a lot of micro gaps, and these micro gaps actually result in creating a porous space-time so that you can travel through it. The distance is not zero, so it isn't instantaneous travel, but it is most likely a superluminal travel, or at least capable of superluminal travel, which means faster than light, which means that, you know, theoretically, instead of it taking, you know, 10 hours to get to Mars, traveling at sublight speeds, you might be able to get there in like an hour, you know, theoretically. I mean, this is the kind of technology that might allow that. So it would be theoretically possible to do these things. And essentially, that's the idea. So this projector system could work almost like a negative 3D printer. Instead of printing space-time, you're using these moments of gravity to sort of distort space-time with multiple gravity wells. So essentially, you're creating a gravity well, almost like you're creating microgravity wells within a corridor, and this creates almost the equivalent of a wormhole. It isn't technically a wormhole because it really isn't a continuous zero-distance space-time topology, but it might be arbitrarily close enough that you can achieve superluminal speed. So yes, you wouldn't be able to go instantly anywhere, but you might be able to go places at so many multiples of speed of light that, for instance, getting to the, you know, if a star were 2 or 3 light years away, maybe you could get there in 2 or 3 weeks, you know? Maybe it takes 2 or 3 weeks to get there. So still, not instantaneous, but totally feasible. Feasible, completely feasible. Like you can imagine loading a spaceship with enough food and water to survive for a couple weeks. So this is a feasible thing. If it could actually be made to work, which is a whole nother topic. I mean, this is all science fiction. So anyways, this idea is essentially a proposal for porous space-time. Like you can actually, instead of creating wormholes in the classic sense, you can create porous corridors of space-time. And so it isn't really like going from A to B instantaneously, but it might be like going from A to B really, really fast. And the other benefit of this is that the target within that space-time corridor, the destination, can act as a gravity well, because it will be the strong gravity well within that porous space-time, and theoretically would actually pull you towards it. So you wouldn't even need propulsion. Once you opened up a corridor with a gravity well target or a celestial object as a target, like a star or, you know, a planet or something, that mass, that object will actually pull you towards it because its force will be able to exert itself across the distance through the porous space-time. So yeah, it's science fiction, it's crazy sounding. I doubt it has any basis in any kind of reality in this universe or any of the other multitude of quantum universes, but it is an interesting premise for science fiction. And, you know, I do think we have to come up with non-Newtonian schemes if we really want to be able to travel through space. I mean, the current Newtonian schemes of throwing together, you know, chemicals, you know, mostly hydrogen and oxygen to power chemical rockets. I mean, it's been a useful scheme up to this point, but it really does have these limits, and it's not just about resources. These particular types of agents are highly explosive. They're very dangerous. So if we really want to make a go of going through space, we're going to have to come up with non-Newtonian drives. We're going to have to come up with engines that do not use the sort of action-reaction Newtonian device to travel through space. We're going to have to come up with devices that leverage magnetic force, gravitational force to essentially travel through space, because we're going to have to come up with means of translating energy to propulsion without some additional input of matter. And so far, we've needed something else. Even with ion drives, you need some source, you know, whether it's mercury or something else. Even with an ion drive, you need a material source to actually create the propulsion. So ion drives, as cool as they are really just the best candle in the universe of candles. They're not the light bulb. We need the light bulb. We need non-Newtonian drives if we actually want to visit nearby stars, but certainly if we want to actually, you know, travel around the solar system in a non-sucky way and actually break out of planet Earth, you know. I don't think, I mean, I'm on the peak oil side of history, so I kind of think these things are all fantasies. I think James Howard Kunstler is correct. This, you know, what I'm doing right now is a kind of mental masturbation, and frankly, is a little bit despicable in a sense because it's kind of delusional. But it is, I do believe there are leveraged technologies. Like miniaturization is a leveraged technology. If you can figure it out, it can allow you to use less resources to solve a problem. So miniaturization, which leads to things like your cell phone being a computer, is feasible and doesn't violate the laws of thermodynamics. There are leveraged technologies that we create, and theoretically, non-Newtonian drives could become leveraged technologies. But these are also challenging times, and you know, the universe probably doesn't hand out free lunches. And so if these things are feasible, it has to be feasible within the scope of what the universe would allow. Anywho, this is a long, long podcast to talk about essentially what amounts to an alternative method or wormhole technology that amounts to turning space-time into jello gelatin or whatever, or pudding. But yeah, you know, it is an interesting premise for the story, and who knows if I get actually end up writing it. I need to finish it. I've written a tiny little short story that's kind of crappy, experimental related to it, but I've never written the story. All I have is an outline. But and I have these other writing projects I have to finish, so fuck it. Like, you know. But anyways, porous space-time. I actually wrote some notes, blog entry, whatever. So if you want to read it, you can read it. Or not. It's all good. Morning.